Turning now to the book of Leviticus, chapter 19 and verse 5. Leviticus chapter 19, verse 5. And if ye offer a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord, ye shall offer it at your own will. And our subject now is getting the spiritual sense. And that's our task as we, in this brief series, go through a number of passages in Leviticus just to get the spiritual sense and message for us in these days. And this is about the free will peace offering, voluntarily made by individuals and made at the temple. And it was an offering of reconciliation to God, and it was a sweet savor offering. In other words, designed to portray those refined aspects of character that have to be achieved for acceptance with God, which Christ the Messiah would one day offer up on our behalf, his own perfections, his own refinements, not only his complete absence of sin and defilement, but positively the wonder and glory and kindness and purity of his every action and his every thought. These are the things that are required. Not only does our sin shut us out of the presence of God and bring eternal punishment to our souls, but the absence of righteousness will never bring us into or deserve for us the blessings of God and eternity. So not only are the sacrifices about atonement, deliverance from sin and the payment of a price, the death of the subject, but also about the deservings, the merit that we require, which only Messiah can offer for us. In the symbolism of the ancient ceremonies that depicted what Christ would one day do, well, the righteousness was represented by the sweet savour of the sacrifices that were for a pleasing aroma. And this is one of them, the peace offerings. So they must be voluntary, but this is what I want to you to particularly notice, and it's been said before, but here in chapter 19, verse 6, it shall be eaten the same day ye offer it, and on the morrow. That is the portion that is for eating by the offerer. And if aught remain until the third day, it shall be burnt in the fire. No eating after the second day. And if it be eaten at all on the third day, it is abominable. It is disgusting. It is vile, is the sense. It shall not be accepted. The whole offering is void, offensive to God. And verse 8, therefore everyone that eateth it on the third day shall bear his iniquity, because he hath profaned the hallowed thing of the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from among the people, excommunicated, thrust out. But all he did was eat the portion that fell to him from his peace offering sacrifice on the third day instead of the second. How does that warrant being thrust out from among the people and lost, and so that he would be out and his family and live among the pagans for survival? Which seems a very harsh, a very terrible punishment. And yet this was what the law laid down, the kindly law of God. The ceremonies must not be abused. They must be entered into sincerely. Nobody must take any part of the ceremonial and bend it to his own advantage, his own secular or personal pleasure or needs. And it may be that people were rather mean or frugal, whichever would be kinder, and may say, well, this is precious. We've reared the animal for this offering, and there's plenty of meat, And there's an abundant supply for us to eat on the third day. So we'll go ahead. But that would be an abuse of the offering. The offering has a distinctively, exclusively religious purpose. It's something very special, very holy, because it represents God's work. Here it is, it represents what the Messiah will one day do. There are the sacrifices, as I mentioned, for atonement, for the taking away of sin. There are the sweet savour offerings. A Messiah is coming, and he will make such an offering that it will deserve for all of us, hopeless and condemned people, an eternity of bliss. And so we participate in this, and we eat some of it, the purpose of which is to signify to us that we receive a portion. Christ will do these things, Messiah will do these things for us. We will be partakers, participants, sharers of it all. And it is a very precious thing, not to be abused, not to be turned into simply feeding the family. And it was dealt with very severely. Now, the interesting thing is, what does it mean for us today? Because the sacrifices, the ceremonial, is at an end, and Christ has come, and he's carried out his work, and these things no longer take place. So what's the purpose today? Is there any other purpose other than teaching the people of those days, step by step, what Christ would accomplish and what he would do, and its preciousness and its importance? And that's where today we're in a certain amount of trouble, because a lot of good Christian people in recent years, preachers, seminaries training preachers, have decided to recoil from looking for the purpose or the meaning of a passage in the Old Testament to us today. And the idea is, you mustn't believe that there is any deeper meaning, any deeper purpose, any ongoing purpose. Even if you believe the Bible to be inspired, this is what they are telling the students in so many seminars today, even though you believe the Bible to be inspired and special, you mustn't expound it as though it is. You mustn't treat it that way. You must look at these passages and say, the message of Moses is strictly limited to what he intended his generation to understand. There is no deeper meaning for subsequent generations. There is no deeper meaning for us. And they have redefined, and I've often mentioned these things to you, and I have a little book on it, but they've changed the definition for the first rule of exposition, interpretation of the scriptures, to this. The sole rule of the interpreter, the only rule, is to determine the human author's meaning, original meaning, to his generation and what they would have understood by it. And that's wrong. That's rationalism. Why, what the reformers used to say was the task of the interpreter, the first task of the interpreter, is certainly to establish what the original author literally meant. But that's not the limit of the expositor's task. What does it mean for us? What is the reason for the ceremony? What's the ongoing reason? And so on. And we're to explore that. But now they've changed it. The sole duty of the interpreter, the only duty, is to establish the literal meaning intention of the human author and what his contemporary hearers would have understood. And that's to turn the Bible into a non-inspired book. It has nothing for the future. It has no deeper meaning. It has no message, no significance. So, friends, I just quote you a very famous verse out of Romans 15 and verse 4, where the Apostle Paul says, and this is the New Testament rule for the interpretation of the Old Testament books, for whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope, anticipation of eternity, hope in Christ. So in other words, there are messages right through Leviticus for us. Even though the ceremonial is ended, those ancient ceremonies and their original purpose to teach of the future Messiah is fulfilled. He has come. He's fulfilled all these things. Well then, there is an ongoing movement. Message, there's a purpose for us. Now, I've mentioned this before, but also some people, the only thing they can find in a passage, such as don't eat the sacrificial meat on the third day, is a biological or practical reason. Oh, it was to avoid digestive disorders and stomach ache and something, perhaps the meat would go off, or there would be something dangerous about it. Well, there may be much in that. It may be that a secret, hidden purpose of God, while he gave the law, was also at the same time to give Israel various hygiene regulations. They didn't have the germ theory of disease. They wouldn't have understood why. But maybe there is hidden in the ceremonies a great deal of protection for them. Yes, many people have explored those things and found that very credible. It may be, but that's not the reason that God says he gave these ceremonies. That is never the reason. And when you look at the New Testament, look, can I twist the verse here in verse 4 of Romans 15? Whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that through patience and comfort of the scriptures we may avoid stomach ache. It's ridiculous, of course. That's not the purpose that lurks behind these things for us. It's so that we might have hope in Christ. So the first thing we do with the ceremonies of Leviticus is look to the message of Christ and what it tells us about his finished work and his offering and death, because that's what they were being prepared for. In all the sacrificial offerings, they are being given the principles of atonement and what is required, a perfect, unblemished offering, and so on and so forth. We'll touch on those things again. Or I could turn you equally forcibly to 1 Corinthians and chapter 10. We read it, and I'll read three verses to you again. Verse 6, now these things, the wilderness events, were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. I won't go through the whole passage, but there's verse 11. Now these things happened unto them for ensamples. Different word. The Greek means patterns. For patterns. And they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. And verse 15. I speak as to wise men. Judge ye what I say. Use your minds, distinguished, determining the sense. The Apostle Paul doesn't say it's anything about digestive disorders or such things. It's about the avoidance of sin and falling and pleasing God. That's what these passages are all about. That's what Leviticus is really all about. If you retitled it, you could call it the Book of Reconciliation. It's all about the supreme holiness of God and the abased pollution of the human heart and the immense difficulty of reconciling man with God, and the elaborate ceremonies depict and illustrate what Christ would have to do to secure that reconciliation. And there is an ongoing message in them all. So going back to Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 6, the offering eaten on the same day. Well, we think, does the passage give a reason why the ceremony was given? Many times it does. Does it speak of Christ according to Romans 15:4, giving us hope? Well, yes, the sacrifice does, of course, and its preciousness. Does it reprove or warn or exhort us, which is an expectation given to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So we prime our minds with these expectations, and we come loaded with them, expectations from the text, looking for what used to be called the pastoral potential of the text. And that's what we must do here. So we're not so interested in our digestive system, but in the spiritual message in the passage. And here it goes. Well, we mustn't profit from any of the things of God, even today. We're not to derive additional enjoyment just for ourselves, beyond the spiritual. A church service, for example, it is a spiritual experience. It's to do with our souls and with God. And we come in order to worship and praise and adore him and see more of him and be convicted and reproved and to be encouraged and lifted up and to learn great things. So when we have someone, they come to a service and you say to them, well, how did you get on? And they say to you, the music wasn't lively enough for me. Well, you see, they're in transgression of this. That is the modern equivalent of the fault committed here. I want something more than spiritual blessing. I want some excitement. I want my body to tingle. I want some rhythm and some secular concert style elevation or thrill. I'm looking for something more than spiritual life and communion with God and blessing and reproof and advance and resolving and to serve him better. I want some personal, even physical level of enjoyment, sensual experience. And that would be the modern equivalent of the fault here. Oh, my dear, says the very frugal wife to the husband, let's take some of that meat for the third day. It's expensive. Let's use it. Oh, no, you can't do that. Moses, this is a sacred encounter, this sacrifice in the temple. You can't turn it to your own physical, personal pleasure and add to it. But that's what is done today on a widespread scale. As this is important, because that's what the embargo on eating the third day really amounts to. That's what it means, that you don't take advantage of the precious and spiritual things of God and add to them and twist them so that really all you're getting is secular material pleasure from them as well. I'll do both. I'll turn it into a concert. I'll have fun and so on. And I've heard many things along these lines. I remember when I was a young Christian in a particular church, I heard about a man, and he was well into his 80s, and the church had a choir. And this man had a foghorn voice, and it would come through everything in the choir, invariably, probably because of his age, well out of tune and all the rest of it. And so the person who was in charge of these things attempted to stand him down from the choir. And his retort, I remember well it being reported around, was, if I can't be in the choir, I am not coming to church. In other words, my pleasure or place or whatever was important to him, my status by being visible in that choir, is of equal significance to me to actually coming to worship. And that's what this... You don't eat on the third day. There's a lot of third day eating going on in our churches today. I remember a lady too. I can't remember the reason, but for some reason, whoever was in charge said she couldn't be any longer on the church flower rota to arrange the flowers. So she stopped coming to church. You see, there's something else beside my soul and the Lord and the worship that is important to me. Something for me. That's eating on the third day. Do you see the parallel? This is the spiritual sense behind the ancient command. And that you can think of many, many applications for. There's a lot of third day eating today in church. Church is something for me. Beyond the worship and the Lord and the doctrine and the teaching, something for me matters too much. And then I take you down, because I must be quick. I'm touching on just a number of passages to give the sense, the idea. In chapter 19 and in verse 9, and when ye reap the harvest of your land, Thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God. This is very beautiful, really. The land was the Lord's. That's affirmed over and over again. We're used, perhaps, to having our own little bit of land, or our own property, or something that we call ours. But in ancient Israel, you didn't call it yours. Well, you did, I think, but you shouldn't have done. It was all the Lord's. And you were the custodian and your family. So it's inheritance. That's your small holding. That's your bit. But it's the Lord's. And some of it is to be left, always, for the poor. Because they're the Lord's too. The people who do not have provision. You are not asked to give them handouts and to be condescending and to say, here is something for you from my harvest. You are just to leave areas of your land which isn't yours at all, so that others may retain their dignity and their self-respect and come and gather and glean as though it was theirs. It's to be common. Common land. All the fringes. All the edges. That's rather beautiful. And the self-respect of those who did not have land is honoured, and they have a contribution of work to gather in their own provisions, and their dignity is maintained, as I said. And that's how it was done. I am the Lord, says the Lord. What is the significance of that today? What goes on? Well, it's easy to see, and the old Reform commentaries all get it first time, you know, that there is no stratification or privilege or ownership, or shouldn't be, in the Church of Jesus Christ. Everybody must be given access to everything. So we don't say, oh, certain people are too dull to understand complex doctrines. We must so order instruction and classes and groups that everybody, whatever difficulty or disadvantage they may have access to the deep things of God and the riches. We're all equally precious to God as saved people, saved by the blood of Christ, and there must be no exclusion. All the riches of the gospel and of the doctrines and then the comforts and blessings of the church have to be open to all age groups and all people. That's the kind of sense, because there are many other provisions for the poor and dispossessed, and they're all of a similar order. And that's the kind of thing that we would learn from it. Let me just go on briefly to chapter 20 and the first five verses. Now, this has been dealt with before. In fact, much of what is in chapter 20 has been dealt with before. And you may say, as you read through Leviticus, well, it's a little tiresome because I keep reading the same things. I get through complex passages and then I read another block of verses which has almost been dealt with before. Yes, but there's always a difference. And that's why they're repeated. And chapter 20, which repeats many things that have gone before, now adds the penalties. And they weren't there before. The penalties for not keeping these rules. That's what makes it necessary, distinctive, and special. But just at the beginning, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, again, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, whosoever he be of the children of Israel or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Molech, that is his children, to the Ammonite god Molech, he shall surely be put to death. Now you've got the penalty. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. It's so terrible. And I will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people. And furthermore, in verse 4, if there's anybody who knew he was delivering his children to Molech and didn't set up a hue and cry, and if the people of the land do anyways hide their eyes from the man when he giveth of his seed unto Moloch, and kill him not in the proper way through the proper regulatory authorities, I will set my face against that man and against his family, and he's punished too. People mustn't be so heartless that they can see children being done away to Moloch and not raise their voices, and to be silent when such evil is committed. So this is about Ammonite child sacrifice, and the parents are responsible and going to be held responsible. Well, the general principle behind this is obvious to us today, and all Christian parents are responsible for protecting their children from being delivered over into the absolute mayhem of unbelief and immorality, which is the present culture. And you have to be so careful. And as children get older, time presents many difficulties. And parents have to be very wise, and very prayerful, and very careful in these days. You have a heavy responsibility. But it's not just literally the parents, it's the churches too. What about the churches? The rule applies to churches collectively. I can tell you about churches that are delivering their young people wholesale over to Moloch and tipping them into the arms of today's young culture, adopting it in the church, encouraging it. I read somewhere that the majority, and I don't think it applies to Britain so much as in the USA, of the pop stars of the 60s, who were instrumental in bringing in the whole new satanic liberated society and anti-moral crusade, learned their arts in churches. They learned how to swing and indulge themselves in every kind of beat and entertainment in church groups, if you please. Well, the condemnation on the Lord's people for harbouring those that deliver their children up to the world and to Satan and to sin and to condemnation is very harsh. So there is an application. No wonder some of these people want to Leviticus to only be about food protection, because they're condemned by its narratives in believing that culture is neutral. It doesn't matter what you encourage people to like and to get into. Anyway, there's chapter 20, the chapters against delivering the children over to Moloch. But now in chapter 21, I took it to something quite different. And the Lord said unto Moses, speak unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say unto them, there shall none be defiled for the dead among his people. Now we've read about defilement by contact with dead bodies before in Leviticus. But what is this that is going on in chapter 21? Why is this rehearsed again? Well, I'll tell you. The passage at the beginning of chapter 21, at least the first six verses, and verses 10 to 12 are about a particular subject. And I'll tell you what it is. They're actually about mourning the dead. That's the subject. Mourning the dead. And the Lord said unto Moses, and you glean it, it's the style of Moses, as you go through, as I've said before, with the narratives of Moses, we expect the subject to be up front. And often the subject emerges as the passage develops. And that is the case here. The Lord said unto Moses, speak unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say unto them, there shall none be defiled. You won't touch dead bodies, except, now look at the strange exceptions, but for his kin. You're allowed to come into contact with the dead if it's your near relative. And then that's defined. Mother, father, son, daughter, brother, sister. That is, as long as the sister is unmarried, and is very close to you. Now, those are the people where there is an exception for them. You may be associated with their dead bodies. You see, this is actually about mourning and funerals and things like that. But verse 4, he shall not defile himself being, or in connection with, a chief man among his people. So a ruler, a prince of a tribe or family, no funeral for him. On his account, no priestly body will be defiled. And what's developing in this passage is a passage which says, as for the priests, this is particularly for the priests who are addressed in chapter 21, and it's going to be a harsher rule for Aaron, the high priest isn't allowed, even if it's his mother or his father or his brother or anything like that. He's not allowed to be involved in a funeral at all. So it is the embargo on funerals, total for the high priest, almost total except for close family, for the other priests. They mustn't be involved in funerals. Did they not have funerals in the ancient tabernacle, followed later by the temple? No. No funerals. Why no funerals? Well, because that was a place where life was proclaimed, not death. There's no death there. It represents Christ, the giver of life, the Messiah who would come, who would secure and purchase life for all his people. There's no death involved. So they're only given a little exemption, the priests, not the high priest, for their nearest kin. And in connection with this, verse 5, they shall not make baldness upon their head or shave off the corner of the beard. This is in connection with funerals. This is what the Canaanites did when there was a funeral. They would make various, of course, they bodily lacerations and cuts and so on, as their very excessive mourning and wailing, but also they would shave parts of the head and beard and things. They won't do that. The outward signs and tokens of death you will not engage in on any account. And by this you won't be defiled, and you'll remain holy unto their God, and they won't profane his name, because they're handling the offerings. The verse goes on to say, that's the reason. There's a ban on funerals in the tabernacle, there in the ancient tabernacle, and the priests mustn't get involved. Except that compassionate, they're allowed to grieve their close relatives privately. But why is this? There it is. It's in verse 6. Because they're handling the offerings. They're in touch with holy things, which are all about reconciliation and life. And so they mustn't be involved in death. So you've got the funeral passage. And there's a few other verses too. In the case of the high priest, well, he's not to touch the dead. He's not even allowed to go out of the tabernacle, out of the house of God, the holy place. Verse 11, neither shall he go into any dead body, nor defile himself, not for his father, his mother, not for anyone, because he represents Christ. He is not himself a holy man. The people know that. He has to make sacrifices for himself, but he represents the one who would come. So there will be no contact ceremonially with death. Well, what do we learn from that? What is it? What is there for us? And, well, we have it in the New Testament. We're taught exactly the same things. We sorrow not as those who have no hope. We don't have funerals of wailing and despair and crying out and screaming. We feel very sorry for the nearest and dearest, for the widow, for the widower, for the children, for the people who feel most keenly the terror and the horror of death. And we want to comfort and identify, but we don't wail And it's not a time of misery. I've been to one or two funerals in my lifetime that have been manifestations of misery. And that's very sad in a Christian church, because our task is not to try to be jolly, not to be foolish and silly. That's what the world does, and play all the pop songs and try and artificially cheer everybody up. But it is to read the promises, the great promises of the scriptures, to be buoyed up by these things, to give comfort and solid hope to those who are most sadly affected. But our funerals mustn't be miserable. There must be an element of triumph in them, because that's what the church is, like the tabernacle or the temple of old. It's not the place of despair, it's the place of anticipation and comfort and life and hope. So we learn from the ancient rules for the priests, and indeed we are a kingdom of priests today. All believers, we are the priesthood, in a sense, under our great high priest, Jesus Christ. Well, dear friends, there are other things that I wanted to touch on. Perhaps I can go back very briefly to chapter 20 and verse 22. Here's a principle that is ignored today. Ye shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and do them, that the land whither I bring you to dwell therein spew you not out. Here's a condition. You better keep my statutes. If you imitate the Canaanites, I may reject you, which of course he did centuries later, just as I rejected the Canaanites. Verse 23, and ye shall not walk in the manner of the nation which I cast out before you, for they committed all these things, and therefore I abhorred them. Is God going to remove the lampstand of many, many churches? Because though they believe in the Lord and have many dear people, nevertheless they've been persuaded to immerse themselves up to the neck in Canaanite culture, in this world's culture, totally. That's a tragedy. Will we see churches going downhill? Churches, even with famous preachers, losing their lampstand within a generation or so? We are seeing it, dear friends. You'd be shocked to see how many churches have fallen and stumbled and lost their distinctive evangelical ethos over the last 20 years. And the process goes on. But I have said unto you, ye shall inherit their land, and I will give it unto you to possess it. But I am the Lord God, which have separated you from other people. And we're called to have a distinctive and separate culture of holiness unto the Lord. So these things are so very, very important. And time is almost up, so I must really go much more rapidly. Chapter 21. And verse 6, well, we've dealt with verse 6, but maybe I can go on to verse 9. Here's an interesting verse. And the daughter of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profaneth her father, she shall be burnt with fire. Well, that's very severe, of course. But the question needs to be asked, who is the priest's daughter today? It's obvious that if there was a priest called aside for holy service to offer the sacrifices and to give the teaching of the meaning of all those beautiful ceremonies of a coming Redeemer and all that he would do and accomplish, and the priest kept himself pure before the Lord, and he was let down by a wayward daughter or son, come to that. Let's not be gender specific. And that person who'd had the privileges of the household and seen beautiful things and all the instruction, completely discredited and shamed the father and the household, what a sad and tragic thing. But who is the priest's daughter today? Could be any of us. Could be a child of the church. Someone with privileges and instruction. Someone maybe had even made a profession. Or it could be a whole church among a group of churches that decided to plunge totally into the world and into things that were abhorrent to God. That's the priest's daughter today, and God will deal with it very firmly. Somebody who betrays all the principles and goes the other way and pulls into the world. And it happens. I don't think it's happened, at least as far as I know, among us. But I do hear of it happening. And people getting into churches who are doing all they can to pull the church into worldliness and false things and shallow things. Of course, a lot of it comes in on the internet today. Who is the priest's daughter? That's the question. You see, we're just learning, really. I'm getting very specific. But we're trying to learn how the principles of the Old Testament apply actually for all time, in principle, even though the ceremonies and their purpose for that time are ended and finished. And these things are important. Chapter 22, verses 1 and 2. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron, this is to the priests again, and to his sons, that they separate themselves from the holy things of the children of Israel. And perhaps that could be more carefully translated. One translation offered by some today is along these lines. Speak unto the priests that they behave themselves very guardedly in relation to the holy things of the children of Israel. And that's right. That's the sense, with due respect to the context. And the idea of this passage is this. It's precautions against the priests cutting corners and becoming little by little insincere. Why, the ceremonies are very complex. What a temptation. I am a priest. I am called of God. When people are watching, I will be fastidious and I will follow the procedure exactly and all the washings and every step. But when there's no one around, let me promote myself. I'm the high priest. There's no one around. I'm only allowed in the Holy of Holies once a year. But I think I'll just slip in there to get something and to tidy something up and to make sure everything is in order. Nobody will see. I'm a sincere man before the Lord. I won't be doing any harm. You can imagine it, can't you? Preparing the accoutrements of worship, the utensils on the altar. Well, there's nobody watching. I haven't washed my hands, but I'll just quickly rearrange them to where they ought to be. It won't do any harm. In little respects, cutting corners. Chapter 22 is, Don't You Dare. Don't you dare. Follow the rules. This is the holy place. Everything is crucially important. In this age, it's not today, in that age, it was important that everything was done exactly as God said it should be done. Well, the application of that today is clear to me, I hope to you. We're Christians. We're a priesthood of believers. Are there all manner of ways in which we're tempted to cut corners? I think of the person, here's an obvious example. It's not a kind example because I'm not suggesting anything. But take the stewards in a service. They've got responsibilities. There are people coming in after the service has started. The downstairs, say, is full. And they've got to keep their eyes open. And as people come in, we don't let them in during the scripture readings. So it can't be done then. Or during the prayers, but during the hymns. Let people in, place them in the right place without commotion, where there's an adequate gap and all the rest of it. So they've got to be on their toes. What a temptation to become a professional. Stand there with your hymn book. Play no part in the worship at all. I'm a steward, don't you know? I'm a sincere believer, but you're completely detached from worship. This chapter says to you, don't you dare. Because we don't want you so following the worship that the people are milling around everywhere and the stewarding isn't going on. So there's a balance to be struck. You've still got to be sincere before the Lord. What about the preacher? That prayer he's praying, is he meaning it himself? He'd better. Don't cut corners. Don't act professionally. What about the Sunday school teacher? Have you really prayed that lesson? Are you not just teaching, but praying too for the children? What about the contact worker in the street or in the park? Have you prayed as much as you've spoken? Don't skip holy things and become insincere. Have you spoken earnestly to somebody and helped them in personal counsel or admonition, been a tremendous help to another person and gone to bed without prayer, skipping quiet times? Are you a man of God, a woman of God when people are with you, but you're watching things on the TV which are not wholesome at all and a sheer waste of your time? Let the secret life be worthy of a Christian man and woman. That's what this is all about, the warnings to the priests. Don't cut corners. I think we've done quite enough for today, and I'm sorry, it may seem a bit negative. I'm trying to show the point behind everything, which is in the deep things of the Word of God. They speak to us in every age. I would have liked to have summed up positively, but I'm over time. Dear friends, let's sing as we close our last hymn.